From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the story of one family's wrongful conviction as IRA terrorists. We talk with Anne McGuire and her son Patrick, the aunt and cousin of Jerry Conlon, whose story was told in the film In the Name of the Father. Anne spent 9 years in prison. Patrick was 13 when he began his 3-year term. Also today, actor Brian Benben, the star of the HBO comedy series Dream On, is now starring in the new film Radioland Murders. Maureen Corrigan reviews an autobiography by activist and professor Howard Zinn called You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton has just addressed the Jordanian parliament. He says the peace treaty signed today by Jordan and Israel marks a historic day of peace. The president says Jordan has flashed a signal to all the Arab world that peace cannot be stopped. He's also promised the Jordanian lawmakers the American people will stand with them.
America's commitment to a comprehensive peace in the Middle East has been backed by a strong pledge that whenever Arabs and Israelis turned the page on the past, the United States would work with them to write a real, practical future of hope. Those who take risks for peace must not stand alone. We will work with Jordan to meet your legitimate defense requirements and to give you the security you deserve.
The president witnessed the signing of the peace treaty today at the border between Israel and Jordan. He was joined by Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin and King Hussein of Jordan. Meanwhile, residents of northern Israel were told to go to bomb shelters today after rocket and mortar attacks this morning. The United Nations says Arab guerrillas fired on North Israel just before the signing of the peace treaty. However, that ceremony was observed far to the south near the Red Sea. The first woman to qualify as a Navy combat pilot has apparently been killed in the crash of her F-14. The crash occurred off the coast of Southern California yesterday, but the name of the victim was just released today. NPR's Martha Raddatz has the story.
Lieutenant Kara Holtgreen had just taken off from the aircraft carrier USS Abraham Lincoln on routine flight operations. The lieutenant, 29 years old, had recently completed her training as the Navy's first female F-14 pilot. The Navy does not yet know why Holtgreen's jet went down, saying only that it hit the water yesterday afternoon and that the lieutenant was lost at sea. Helicopters and Navy ships continue to search the area, but have been unable to locate Holtgreen's body. The Navy says Holtgreen did not eject from the aircraft. The radar intercept officer on board, Lieutenant Matthew Clemish, was able to eject from the F-14. He was immediately rescued and suffered only minor bruises. Both Clemish and Holtgreen were based at Miramar Naval Air Station in San Diego. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
The government says orders for durable goods rose 0.1% in September. More requests for ships and tanks pushed up orders for transportation items. That offset a drop for cars and airplanes. Durable goods are items that last for 3 years or longer. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has risen more than a point to 3,851. Trading is heavy. The Nasdaq is up almost 4 points at 762. This is NPR.
We're having technical problems. We're having technical problems with the newscast. We hope to return to the newscast momentarily.
The group's assessment is based on its analysis of votes on 11 issues. UPI's Carol Van Dam has more from Capitol Hill.
Despite high hopes for the self-proclaimed reform... Nothing much has changed when it comes to campaign finance reform and lobby reform. Public Citizen President Joan Claybrook says it is true Republicans filibustered the bills to death, but Democrats must also share in the blame.
We believe that the Democrats were negligent in not bringing this bill forward sooner. This is the conference report. The bill went through the House in November of 1993, but the conference report did not come up ever.
In the group's so-called corruption curve on political reform, 26 senators and 160 representatives were given an F, most of whom are Republicans. Carol Van Dam, Capitol Hill.
U.S. aid officials say Haiti will need $550 million in foreign aid over the next year, and Washington plans to supply $200 million of that. The figures were announced by the top U.S. aid official for the region after a five-day visit to Haiti. Mark Schneider said he found victims of repression under Haiti's military rulers willing to accept the appeal for reconciliation. From Monitor Radio News, I'm Bob Dunn on PRI.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The movie In the Name of the Father told the story of Jerry Conlon and three friends who were unjustly convicted of being the IRA terrorists who bombed an English pub in 1974. My guests are Conlon's aunt, Anne McGuire, and her son, Patrick, who were convicted of being part of that bombing conspiracy. McGuire spent 9 years in prison. Patrick was 13 at the beginning of his three-year term. He's now 33. She's 58. They were known as the McGuire Seven, along with Anne's husband, her oldest son, her brother, a friend, and Jerry Conlon's father, who were also all wrongly convicted. Their names were cleared in 1991. Sir John May, who led an inquiry into the bombing, described the McGuire Seven's convictions as the worst miscarriage of justice he'd ever seen. Anne McGuire has written a memoir called Miscarriage of Justice. In Jerry Conlon's memoir, he describes how Anne McGuire was implicated in the conspiracy. Conlon and his friend Paul Hill were being interrogated and beaten and told that the beatings wouldn't stop until they named names. So Paul picked McGuire's name. Then Conlon was pressured into confirming her involvement. McGuire is still angry with both of them.
They brought Paul Hill in first, and he was dragged in. He couldn't stand up. He was badly beaten. But it still didn't give him the right to give my name as a total stranger to him. I'd only met him once, and I don't take any excuses from any of them for giving innocent people's names, because my two sons, Patrick, who's here now, was 13 years of age. Vincent was 16, and they got terrible beatings from the police, and they didn't make statements. So I don't take any excuses for them.
You know, another thing that Jerry Conlon has said is that one of the reasons why your name was given is because it seemed so absurd to even think that you could have been a member of the IRA. After all, you were such a respectable, law-abiding woman. You had pictures of Churchill and the Queen of England on your wall. Your husband had been in the British Army. So, you know, he thought no one would ever believe you were really a terrorist. What do you make of that?
Gerald Conlon is lying when he says that I had pictures of the Queen and Churchill on my walls. There were no such pictures. There was a bust of Winston Churchill, which was in Patrick's room. There were all the flags of all the nations, which Patrick gathered, little flags, on his wall. He just continuously lies to cover himself, because he knows in his heart and soul that he done wrong by giving my name. Now, I have said before, why did they give my name? Why not his own mother? Why not his sisters, his aunts, his girlfriends? This goes for Paul Hill too. They had ample people in Northern Ireland, names that they could have given. But why? And they've yet to answer why they give my name.
Have you ever talked about it with Conlon?
When he came out of prison, an uncle of the family phoned me and said that he was there with him, and they were celebrating. And, you know, could he come up and see me? Well, the family were still angry because they had 15 years in prison to write a letter, but he never did. And Gerard Conlon, I said to him, well, Gerard, you know, he'd just come out of prison and he was high, you know, I mean, out of prison, it was a big thing. And I knew that he had to go back to Belfast to with his mother and sisters to see various people. And I said to him, when you come back to London, phone me and we will make arrangements to meet. That was him and I, and talk it over first. And then I would say to the family, well, he has apologised if he had done that. Now, he says that when he spoke to me on the phone, he said, I'm sorry, Aunt Danny, but he didn't. And he also said that he said that in the interrogating room. I'm sorry, Aunt Danny, he didn't. He turned round and told me to tell the truth. And the policeman walked him out of the room.
Before the police came for you, you already knew that your nephew had been arrested under suspicion for the Guildford bombing because his father had come to your house from Ireland to tell you how upset he was about that arrest. So you knew something was wrong with your nephew when the police came, but you had no idea that you would be dragged into the story. What did the police tell you when they came to the door?
Well, when they came to the door, Amory opened the door, and they actually threw her against the wall with the force of the door opening.
This was your 8-year-old daughter?
My 7-year-old then. And, you know, they just ordered me into my sitting room because I was in the kitchen starting to do a wash in the machine. And they said they were just there to ask questions about Gerard Conlon. And I told them that I knew nothing about Gerard Conlon or any other nephew in Belfast because they lived over there and we lived in London. I knew more about the boy next door than what I would of anybody living in Belfast. And they weren't satisfied, asked questions indoors, that they said that we would go down to the local police station. And they took the boys, the men had already gone back to the pub to have a drink. And I told them where the men were. I just pointed through the window. You could see the pub through my window. And they went and arrested the men in the pub and took the three boys and myself down to the local police station.
Patrick, were you in the house at the time?
No, I was, I'd come out from the school earlier, had something to eat, and I'd gone out to the local youth club, which I went to every Tuesday and Thursday. And this particular night, which was on a Thursday, coming out of the youth club, myself and my friends noticed a lot of strange cars that were hanging around, and we gathered that they were police, but took no real notice. And then the police took off, and then within minutes, another friend of mine said that the police have stopped outside your house and they're searching it, they're in and out. And I just ran up the road before he could finish telling me. The front door was closed, there was a crowd outside. I made my way through the crowd, knocked on the door, and I was greeted by a policeman, or a policewoman, who asked me, what did I want? And I said, well, I live here. And then she just grabbed hold of me, pulled me in, and shouted out, we got another one here.
Did you have any idea what was happening?
No, I actually thought there was this might sound strange, but I actually thought there was a party going on at one time, because there were so many people around, you know? Not that we had parties in our house too often, but all sorts of things are happening just too quickly. But there was no reason for me to think that there was the police were there for any other reason than they've made a mistake. But there was a bit of excitement with it as well. I mean, you know, if it happens now, I'm a lot older now, I know the seriousness of it. But as a child, you take on board, you know, the atmosphere. And it was like having the TV cops in your front room for real.
Yeah.
You know, guns and dogs and, you know, wow, I can tell all the kids tomorrow, like, you know. But that tomorrow never came.
Patrick, you were 13 when the trial started. Did you understand what was happening at the trial or was
No.
it going over your head?
I did not know what was going on. But as in them days then and now, I know. And that's been our greatest strength. We know the truth. We know we had nothing at all to do with this. And there's only one other person above us that knows that, and that's God.
And what was the trial like for you? Did you understand what was happening?
No, I did. Just like Patrick, I mean, I was just a mother and a housewife. And all I knew was to go out and work hard and to make beds and cook dinners and washing and ironing. I mean, I knew nothing about scientific evidence or anything like that. And but I tell you what, at the end of the trial, I'm sure if we'd have put our heads together, we could have made a bomb between us. Like, there was not much talking about what was going into the bombs and all that.
What happened to you when you were pronounced guilty? What was the first thing that went through your minds?
Well, I just, 14 years, I was never going to be with my family again. My children were going to be orphans. I mean, out of all the people that were arrested at that time, all the men and that, my children were the only children left orphans. Both parents were taken away. Our home was taken off us and that. And I just couldn't, you know, I just screamed, no, you know, I just, this couldn't be happening to us when we were so innocent.
Patrick, what went through your mind?
Well, I by that time, I didn't really care. I mean, I'd come all this way with my family that I wanted to be found guilty. I didn't want to go home. If they had said not guilty for me, where was I going to go? They were going to release me to where? My family are being locked up. I've got no home. So in a certain respect, I was quite pleased that I'd been found guilty. And, you know, like, as I said, I'd, at that particular time, you know, when it sunk in, I wish I hadn't, like, you know, but there was no way I was going to go home because I'd been through the system with them.
My guests are Anne and Patrick McGuire. Anne McGuire has written a memoir called Miscarriage of Justice. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Anne McGuire and her son Patrick, who were wrongly convicted of the IRA bombing of a London pub. They're related to Jerry Conlon, also convicted for the bombing. His story was told in the film In the Name of the Father. Patrick, did you learn a lot about crime when you were in prison? One of the things people often worry about when young people go to prison is that they'll come out more toughened than they were when they went in.
That's right. I mean, there's quite a few things I resent that have happened to, you know, that have been taken away from me as a child. But they taught me things that I should never have learnt. Well, not have learnt at that age.
Like what?
I had, you know, like stealing cars, breaking an entry, you know, had to sort out a burglar alarm, checks, you know, like credit cards, drugs. I mean, I had my first experience of drugs in prison. And I've put them all to use over the years, unfortunately, but I had to because the system that I was thrown back out into, you know, you have to remember that my mother and father are still in prison. There's no one out there waiting for me. No one's going to help me. So all the experience I learned over the years in prison, I put to use. Okay, I was being very angry at the same time, but I survived, and it was the only way I was going to survive.
So when you got out of prison a few years earlier than your parents, you turned to stealing and things like that?
No, not straight away. I did try. But the system wouldn't allow me. You know, the police were harassing me. They were picking me up and arresting me and beating me still. And this is still happening today. It was only just before Christmas last year, I was arrested and beaten. So,
had you done anything?
Oh, I got off that case. But, yes, I went to the local my local police station with my solicitor and made an official complaint. And up to now, it's worked. The late nights are coming in now, the dark nights, and I just have to keep looking over my shoulder.
Well, they did say to him after the trial,
we'll see you later.
We'll see you.
We'll see you.
And that meant that they'll get him.
Yeah.
And they'll do it their way.
See, and that's another thing I resent with the likes of Jerry Condon and Paul Hill. They came out of prison like heroes. And the world, it seemed that the world was waiting for them, you know? I came out of prison with my brother.
To nothing.
To nothing. We were kicked out of prison about 7 o'clock in the morning. No one waiting for us. No money, no family, no fast cars, no clothes, no big houses. We didn't fly to America. We didn't fly here, Australia, or anywhere else. It seems that we should have all made statements all them years ago, and put people down and sent people to prison, and we might be heroes ourselves.
And was it hard for you to adjust to prison life?
Well, it was, because, I mean, I was a mother, wasn't I, and had a family, young family, and everything stopped. All of a sudden, I'm there on a prison wing, scrubbing prison floors, and wondering what was happening to my two sons in prison. I knew my son outside and my daughter had gone to Belfast with my sister. I still worried about them because I knew, especially John, wouldn't have settled in Belfast, being born and bred in London. But Patrick and Vince, all sorts were going through my head. You hear of different things happening in prison. And I just cried and cried every day. I mean, I was scrubbing the floors and the bucket was filling with the tears. I just couldn't stop crying and praying for God to watch over and protect them and keep them from harm. And every time I heard my name called from the office, the chief's office, I used to say, oh, it's now. They're going to say I'm going home. They've made a mistake. And that went on for 9 years, 4 months.
How much did you see each other during the years you were in prison?
Not very much, maybe twice a year.
It took them 7 months to arrange a family visit. 7 months after we were arrested, and that was never known. Actually, a woman that was in for the murder of her husband with a boyfriend, I had to watch them having visits every month, you know. And 7 months, I mean, and when I did see Patrick and Vincent and my husband, I mean, they were just total strangers. I mean, we all just didn't know what to say to each other or what to do. Because here we were, one day you're in your own home and the next time you see each other, you're in a prison, surrounded by about six officers. There were at least four men officers with them and two male officers with me. And you were, they were at one side of the table and I was at the other side. You know, and it was just, it's unbelievable. One has to go through a prison sentence and these things to really feel how it is. You know, it's, people say, you know, tell us about it and that. It's hard to explain. You have to experience it yourself to understand the pain and the agony that it puts you through.
When you got out of prison and you were about 50, where did you have to live? Let me explain here that your husband got out a year before you.
That's right.
And he had actually asked to stay in prison an extra year so that you could get out at the same time.
That's right.
Were you touched by that?
Well, yes. I mean, I knew that he would do it, you know. That was him. That is what he is like. And even Vincent, Patrick wanted to stay on with Vincent.
Yeah.
Till he'd done his time, you know. He didn't want to go out without his brother Vincent, to leave him behind. And they could have released me with my husband on the last parole. And even the officers in Durham Prison, they didn't say to me outright, but this is what they believed, that I was going to go out with my husband on his release date, on my last parole date. And even they were shocked when they turned it down. They just wouldn't release us together. And he got the flat and that, and I come out to that flat.
And what did you think of the movie In the Name of the Father?
Not a lot. It was very powerful, and it did show that the interrogation. When I was told about it, I was delighted to hear that a movie was being made, especially where Giuseppe Conlon, the father, was concerned. And, you know, we would have given any help whatsoever to that movie Mr. Sheridan approached us before he made it. The movie, as far as I was concerned, wasn't about the Maguire Seven. It was about father and son, and that should have been kept in that respective father and son, because there was enough material, there was enough suffering in that family for a good movie to be made, you know, with a father dying in prison. Gerard Conlon's mother went through a lot too, and I couldn't understand why they brought us into it, but why did they tell lies?
How do you feel that your story was misrepresented by the film?
Well, in the book, again, I have written the book and I have told every detail as it happened. And most of the beatings that I got at Guildford was because they kept saying that Paul Hill and Gerard Conlon were in my kitchen and I was showing them how to make bombs. And I just says that is not true. Paul Hill never, ever was in my house. I asked the police to go and ask Paul Hill to describe the colour of my kitchen walls, the shape of my kitchen. Was it long, small, big, large, you know? And for that to be put in the movie annoyed me. It's calling me a liar.
Because in the movie, they come to your house and have a meal as soon as they get to
London. Well, in the movie, Mr. Sheridan has got Paul Hill and Gerard Conlon brought this parcel over from Belfast with meat and stuff in it from Gerard Conlon's mum, which never, ever happened. I mean, that side of my husband's family never, ever sent us anything. And for that to be shown, and Sarah Conlon, Gerard Conlon's mum, saying, "Now go straight to your Auntie Annie," that was not, that never happened. It was his Uncle Cuey Maguire and Aunt Kitty, who they all came to in London. And if any parcels were sent, and if any time they ever come over, it was straight to them. They never came near our house.
The movie has Paul Hill and Gerry Conlon going right to your house. Does Gerry Conlon say that that's what happened, or is this just dramatic liberty that was taken?
No,
he never denied it.
He never denied
and
it.
And we know this for a fact because we actually met Jim Sheridan, and Gerry Conlon gave his consent. You know, he must have signed some sort of forms for the film to go ahead.
Is there anything else that you feel you need to do to clear your names?
Not at all. When our names were finally cleared, it was in 1990-91. And when it was on the news and we were being interviewed, the first thing I said was, I don't need anyone on this earth to tell me that I am innocent. I don't need no big top judge, no top lawyer, the Queen of England. I don't need no one to tell me I'm innocent. I could have went to my grave knowing that. And as I said earlier on, there's one more man that knows what I know, and he is God. And I can face him any time, no problem. Can the others?
And you got out of prison before your name was cleared. You got out of prison because your time was up.
That's right.
What did it feel like for you when your name was actually cleared?
Well, it was a big...
20 years too late.
You know, too late, as Patrick said. It was... a bit of the heaviness off my shoulder, you know, I mean. But the scar is there. That scar will be there on all of us to the day we die. And, you know, it's now when bombs go off and that, I shiver, you know. I don't know if the police are going to come knock on my door again or bust in. You know, we just don't know. They haven't done it up to now, but one doesn't know. And when, you know, as I said now, I won't even go down the West End shopping on my own because for the fact that even if it was a bomb hoax, I wouldn't run. I would stand still because I would, it's like a sense of guilt, isn't it? I mean, if you run and somebody sees you, oh, I seen that woman Maguire running. And it's that scar's there. We never be a normal family again.
Anne and Patrick Maguire. Anne Maguire's new memoir is called Miscarriage of Justice. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we meet Brian Benben, the star of the HBO comedy series Dream On. He's also starring in the new movie comedy Radioland Murders. And Maureen Corrigan reviews the new autobiography of activist and professor Howard Zinn called You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton spoke to the Jordanian parliament last hour and commended the lawmakers on their step toward peace. Mr. Clinton was an official witness today when Jordan and Israel signed a peace treaty ending decades of official war. The president says the true enemies of Jordan and Israel are those who would destroy this new peace.
They stoke the fires of violence. They seek to destroy the progress of this peace. To them I say, you cannot succeed. You will not succeed. You must not succeed, for you are the past, not the future.
The president has promised that the United States will stand closely with Jordan and provide that country the defense and security that it deserves. A South African judge has rejected the death penalty for three convicted killers of American student Amy Beale. Judge Gerald Friedman has instead ordered the men to serve 18-year prison terms. Friedman ruled Beale was murdered solely because she was white. Her killers are black. Witnesses reported the men had been shouting anti-white slogans as they murdered her. In a new study, researchers have found an increased risk of breast cancer among women who have had an abortion. But as NPR's Joe Palca reports, these results must be looked at cautiously.
Over the years, scientists have arrived at conflicting answers to the question, does having an abortion increase a woman's risk of getting breast cancer? In the latest study, researchers from the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Seattle asked 845 women who had breast cancer and 961 women selected at random whether they'd ever had an abortion. Women who'd had an abortion were more likely to have developed breast cancer, a risk that went up for women who had their abortions before they were 18 or after they were 30. Now, the size of the increased risk was not very great, and there are problems in gathering data by means of interviews, as was done in this study. Still, the results are bound to prompt more studies about the relationship between breast cancer and abortion and fuel the debate over abortion in this country. This is Joe Palca in Washington.
A bipartisan group is calling for an end to Senate gridlock. The members of Action, Not Gridlock, is composed of retired senators and other senior politicians, including former Senators William Proxmire and Barry Goldwater. They're asking Senate candidates to commit to changing filibuster rules. The group notes there were more filibusters last year than in the first 108 years of the Senate combined. They say in a letter to candidates that this tactic threatens the very concept of majority rule. On Wall Street, stock prices closed lower today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 2 points to end at 3,848. Declining issues led advances by a 4-3 margin in very heavy trading. This is NPR. A consumer group says some hospitals are still violating a federal law that forbids patient dumping. Public Citizens Health Research Group says the government cited 86 hospitals in 22 states last year and in the first quarter of this year. The government alleges those facilities refused to treat emergency patients for non-medical reasons. The report also says 5 hospitals and 1 doctor have been fined. 2 Texas hospitals have voluntarily pulled out of the Medicare program after repeatedly breaking regulations. A co-author of the group's report says many incidents of patient dumping aren't reported, and she says no state or region is exempt. The Ford Motor Company reports the best third quarter of any of the nation's big 3 automakers. Ford earned more than, $1 million for the 3-month period. NPR's Don Gagne reports.
Ford's third quarter financial performance was on the very high end of analyst projections. The company earned $1.1 billion in the July through September sales period. That's an improvement of more than 140% over the same period a year earlier. GM's third quarter earnings were just over $500 million, while Chrysler topped $600 million. Ford continued to take advantage of strong demand for vehicles. Pickup trucks sold well, as did Ford's brand new Windstar minivan. The company's also been able to cut down on rebates and other incentives. Ford Chairman Alexander Trotman, in a statement released this morning, said he expects the good news to continue, pointing to signs that Europe is in the early stages of economic recovery. This is Don Gagne in Detroit.
Authorities in southeast Texas are estimating damage from flooding in their region. The state's insurance commissioner says early totals on insured property damage stands at $700 million, but some of the worst affected areas are still underwater. Officials are hesitant to offer estimates on total damage. The sheriff in Montgomery County estimates between 4,000 and 5,000 homes are damaged. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Brian Benben, is the star of the HBO comedy Dream On. He plays Martin Tupper, a book editor in New York who is the divorced father of a teenage son. Benben does a share of double takes on Dream On, and his face often registers a how-could-they-do-this-to-me expression. Now he gets to show how well he can walk into doors, fall out of windows, and hang from ledges in the new movie comedy Radioland Murders. Dream On premiered in 1990. Although Benben insists he isn't quite as neurotic as his character Martin Tupper, Benben says he relates to nearly everything about Tupper.
What I liked most about the character and about the show that we do is that everybody's pretty flawed, and everybody's capable of lying and dissembling with the best of them, but it doesn't mean they're not nice and likable people, you know. They're just flawed, you know.
Your character of Martin Tupper is always getting into predicaments where he has to, you know, he's an editor at a not very good publishing company, so he has to take on these books that he knows are ridiculous, he knows they're awful, but he has to shepherd them through. And his best friend does one of these morning talk shows where he has to do ridiculous cooking with washed-up celebrity type segments. And they both know that they're trapped in these ridiculous professional situations. And I'm wondering if you've ever felt trapped in a situation like that yourself in your own career, being in a play or in a movie that you felt like, God, this is really awful, and I'll have to do my best.
Absolutely. It's frightening even to think about. But, you know, I've definitely had those experiences. And it's interesting because I've talked to other people, and it always seems to be the same. First, you know, you have this dawning sort of slow realization that this is a real turkey you're involved with. Then you spend a lot of time trying to save the whole project.
Right.
And then by the time you're done, you're just desperately trying to save yourself, you know. Nothing else is of any concern.
Well, how do you try to save yourself in a situation like that?
Well, you just try to protect your performance and you know, not trying not to look as much a moron as you feel that you probably are, you know. There's a variety of ways of doing that. It depends on the instance, I suppose. The interesting thing about this character in the television series is that I think that he, you know, he's always trying to turn some kind of failure into, yes, that was actually a victory, you know what I mean? I think he's very forward moving in that respect.
Now, on Dream On, your ex-wife, Judith, is now remarried to someone named Dr. Richard Stone, and he's the most perfect human being in America. He works with Mother Teresa when he isn't being a guest on Nightline or isn't on the set of a made-for-TV movie about his illustrious life. Is there someone who's the equivalent of that in your life, someone who's, like, very perfect in a situation similar to a situation you were once in, and he's always showing you up, and it drives you mad?
I don't think so, primarily because I have no male friends.
It's one way to avoid this problem.
That's right. All my friends are women. So I think I've successfully avoided that particular problem.
Now, how does your self-image compare to Martin's on the show? His self-image usually isn't all that good. As an actor, I think you probably can't afford to have too bad of a self-image because you always have to pass yourself off as kind of confident.
Well, I guess that's the big conflict with actors is that, you know, their egos are huge, but they're, you know, I don't know if their self-worth is very large, and I'd be hard put to even, you know, even begin to sort of psychoanalyze myself in that respect. But what was the question?
Self-image.
Is this major avoidance or what?
One night when I was just flipping around the channels with my remote control, I saw you in what I thought was probably a tough guy role.
And I have no idea what I was watching, and it was like in the 3 minutes before I went to sleep, so I had to like turn off the TV.
Probably the best way to watch some of the movies.
what were my options? What might it have been?
Well, I don't know. What was I wearing? Was I wearing a fez and a caftan?
No.
That must have been one of my...
No.
I don't know. What was I wearing? A suit? Did I have real short hair?
You had short hair. Real short hair.
Oh.
I mean, it wasn't like, wow, look at that really short hair.
I don't know. I did a movie with Dolph Lundgren called I Come in Peace. I don't know. It might have been that. I don't know. But I don't know what you possibly could have been watching. A heavy. I was a heavy.
Yeah. You were. You were the heavy. I looked up I Come in Peace in Leonard Maltin's movie guide because I haven't had the pleasure of seeing
it. And
the movie.
Wasn't in there, right?
No, of course it's in there. But you co-star with Dolph Lundgren, who was one of the boxers in Rocky IV, right?
Right, right.
And
I gave him some pointers, actually, after that.
Really? So this is a cop movie where you're partners and the bad guy is an alien from outer space who's harvesting people for their endorphins.
Pretty embarrassing, isn't it?
Well, so... Let me
just tell you,
yes.
It was directed by Craig Baxley, an ex-stuntman and a second unit director. He was a very talented guy who directed the picture very well, but, you know, the script, it left a little bit to be desired in terms of just what it was about. And at one point I said to Craig, I don't know, I don't think this really makes sense. We were talking about some scene, and he sort of leafed through all the pages and said, none of the rest of it does either, you know.
Right.
What are you going on about? But, I worked with Dolph, and, you know, Dolph, I'm like 5'6", and Dolph is like 6'7", so I was really like a hand puppet next to him, and I had to wear lifts in my shoes so I could get in the same shot. But it was fun. We ran through a lot of naphthalene explosions. You know? How often do you get to do that?
Did it hurt?
No, it didn't. I mean, you know, I kept looking at Dolph and thinking, God, I wonder how dangerous this is. But he had this sort of implacable expression on his face that I realized later he always has. So I don't know what the actual danger quotient was, you know.
My guest is Brian Benben, star of the HBO comedy series Dream On and the new film Radioland Murders. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with actor Brian Benben. You grew up in the Hudson Valley in New York. Is this growing up in the country?
Yeah, I grew up actually in apple orchards. Well, I had a house, but it was in apple orchards. You know, I didn't live in a lean-to or anything. But I grew up in a farming community mostly.
Now, your father was a produce buyer for a supermarket, for a small store?
Yeah, for A&P, the chain.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was... He was a big man in lettuce and onions and celery and apples and he I think every kind of fruit or produce he has bought at some point. He's retired now.
Did you get free vegetables at home?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, and when my mother would go away, he was a wonderful cook. Cheese and onions, and he'd eat out of the skillet so he didn't have to dirty another plate. He had it all worked out.
So, did you ever have to work in the supermarket?
No, but I worked in a lot of packing plants. I worked in apple packing plants and onion packing plants and processing potatoes and all that stuff.
Were you always dreaming of a way to get out?
Absolutely, I absolutely hated it. Actually, I was just up there visiting, and I drove by a little steel yard that I used to work in. I accelerated. I wanted to get by it as quickly as possible.
Did you think acting would be your ticket out?
Oh, I know. Not really. I always wanted to act, and I of course, never thought that I'd, you know, make a living at it practically, I suppose. But I didn't really train to do anything else, so I must have had some faith.
Did you act in school?
No, I didn't.
That's surprising.
Yeah. No, I started acting when I was about 17, and actually I sort of fell into a nice situation. It was up near in High Falls, New York, and these people who had been, I think, chased out of New York City had a theater up there, and we were doing these very... sort of avant-garde plays, you know, by Slavomir Mrozek and people like that. And then when I moved to New York, I started working in sort of a radical gay theater where we were doing equally strange things, you know. So it was just and I, of course, thought that everyone's youth as an actor was like that. And I'd watch these things or hear people talk about their the beginning of their career, and I always thought, that's ridiculous. Nobody goes to college and studies acting and does musicals. They all work at avant-garde theaters, you know, where everyone wears leather, you know.
How did you end up in radical gay theater? I know you're married now.
Yeah.
I mean, to a woman.
Well, I wasn't radical or gay, and I'm still not, but I was to a woman.
Well, I mean, people marry other people of their own sex. It's just
absolutely.
Not, it's just not a City Hall ceremony.
Yeah, no, it was a great place to work. You didn't have to be gay to work there. Most of us weren't, you know. But it was a man named Doric Wilson, who was a, that's Doric Wilson,
mm-hmm.
who was a playwright, sort of a radical gay playwright, and an offshoot of our theater was the Glines, I believe, you know, and so, which is here in New York, I don't know if they still exist, but he was, you know, he dedicated this theater doing plays by, with either a gay theme or by gay playwrights, which was, you know, really all-encompassing, you know, so we did all kinds of stuff, and it was a wonderful place to work, it really was.
But it was okay to be a straight actor in there? I mean, it's like some gay theater groups, some, you know, groups like that, you have to be like part of the circle to be part of the group.
Not at all. That was one of the wonderful things about it. You know, it was in the 70s, and there's a lot of sort of radical stuff still happening. But mm-hmm. but it was a very nice atmosphere, you know, and it was sort of, it didn't break down along any kind of lines at all. There were gay people who worked there. Most of the actors were straight. As I remember, and it was a wonderful, very protected place to work. Just a little different, you know. I mean, it's not every bathroom, you know, that the public has to use there, you know, has a penis collage in it, you know, in like ours did. So, you know, when your parents come down and go see a show, it gives them something to think about as they're weaving out, you know.
Well, what did they think of it?
Well, they didn't say much, you know. I think they think, oh, we're so proud, you know.
Were they worried, among other things, that, not only is it in these productions we don't understand, but now everybody's going to think he's gay?
I don't know. I didn't talk to him much about it, you know. They seemed to take it in stride pretty much, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it was a basement theater. I lived in that theater actually for a little while when I had no place else to go. So, you know, I'd stay there. We'd do the play. Everybody would go home, and I'd stay. You know,
talk about a life in the theater.
Yeah, on the living room set. You know, it was. It was actually kind of relaxing. You know.
Now, on HBO, the character you play is Jewish, and I know in the Gangster Chronicles, which I'll confess I haven't seen, you played Meyer Lansky,
right?
The famous Jewish member,
right.
of the underworld. And I wonder if you've often or been cast as Jewish, if you're Jewish yourself. And...
No, I'm not. I'm on Dream On. His mother's Jewish, so that would make him Jewish. He's half Jewish.
Right.
I don't know. I've played a lot of Jewish guys and a couple of Jewish girls, now that I think of it. And, you know, it's that radical gay theater. You really get to stretch as an actor and as an actress, I might add. I'm my people were Polish Catholics, actually. And though I'm not a Catholic, I've accepted Buddha as my personal savior. Oh, that gave you a little start, didn't it? I can tell. You know, you're thinking, oh, no, here we go. That's the end of this interview. The Buddha in me loves the Buddha in you. You never hear anybody say that, do you? That's the problem with America. I've had absolutely no religious training or background whatsoever, and don't want any.
Uh-huh.
I read all the big books, you know, the good books, and that's enough. Yeah, they're all Polish Catholics, and my mother's from German extraction from down south.
The name Brian Benben, your last name Benben, is I've never heard the name before.
Yeah, well, you know, I certainly didn't change it to that. You know what I mean? You know, originally it was John Benben, but I wanted to throw the Brian in there to sort of more cross-cultural kind of reference. You know what I mean? the tip of the Martin to you. It's a very strange name. Although, you know, it's interesting because I was just visiting my family and they someone had had the errant, you know, impulse to send off and get the Benben book to see where all the Benbens were. And actually, there are quite a few of them in this country and some in Belgium and France as well. And I'm sure we're all related. I think we've all actually procreated from raiding warthog dens or something long ago.
Did you have problems as a kid growing up with a last name that rhymed?
Does it rhyme?
Well, it repeats itself. Maybe
it
that's the more precise
itself.
Way of putting it.
Yeah, it's onomatopoeic. I don't know. I don't know. What does that mean? Well, no, I mean, you know, I mean, they're the requisite sort of nicknames. Benny, I know that's hard to believe, you know, but people were very creative where I grew up.
So what's in your near future? Any other movies or projects coming up?
I don't know. I'm sort of waiting to hear about whether or not we have another season of Dream On. It'll be our sixth season, our last one, and I think I could probably get through another short season. I think the it gets a little tougher every season because now, like one of our writers told me, said we're starting to do stories like Martin dates a girl with big ears, you know. But Martin dates a girl with hairy knuckles, you know, stuff like that. So I think that we're sort of approaching, coming to an impasse there, you know.
If Dream On ends in the near future, is there a particular type of role you'd like to try?
Oh, you know, I take every, you know, my own personal experience is that nothing leads to anything. I know that sounds depressing, but that's just been my particular experience.
It's a nice philosophy of life.
Yes, isn't it? I embrace it wholeheartedly, too. You know, why bother? I take each job as it comes. You know, I guess I'd like to do something a little different now, but I don't care. As long as I work with good people and worthy projects that are interesting and a little different, that's all I care about. I know that's not a lot to ask, but that's what I'm asking for. What I'll receive, who knows?
Well, good luck. I thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thanks. It's been a lot of fun.
Brian Benben stars in the HBO comedy Dream On and in the new movie Radioland Murders. This is Fresh Air. There's been another major step toward peace in the Middle East. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. A peace treaty signed today between Jordan and Israel, ending 46 years of war and hostility. Paul Miller has the story of that signing ceremony in the Sinai Desert on the border between Israel and Jordan. President Clinton is in the area attending the ceremony, later speaking in the Jordanian capital, Amman. Jackie Leiden has that report. Linda Wertheimer talks with two men who will not be returning to Congress, their views about what sort of House of Representatives it would be if indeed it were Republican-controlled. Also, the guitar music of Bill Frisell, a jazz stylist and a big fan of the cartoonist Gary Larson.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Throughout his academic career of over 30 years, historian Howard Zinn didn't just lecture and write about history, he was part of it. Zinn took on an outspoken and often controversial role in the civil rights movement and was an early opponent of the Vietnam War. Zinn has a new autobiography called You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train. Critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Conservative critics of education regard professors like Howard Zinn as tweedy manifestations of the Antichrist. After all, in his 1982 book, A People's History of the United States, Zinn uncovered the blemishes on our idealized portraits of Columbus and the Founding Fathers. Zinn never obscured his controversial arguments with glutinous helpings of high theory, nor did he confine his radicalism to his research. He helped hide the fugitive anti-war activist Daniel Berrigan, and he himself was jailed for acts of civil disobedience during the 60s. Zinn retired from teaching at Boston University in 1988. At the end of his very last class, he led his students out of the lecture hall and onto a picket line. It's tempting to view Zinn as a 60s dinosaur at best, a grandstanding Mr. Chips at worst. But that would be projecting the cynicism of our own gray time onto him. You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train is that most old-fashioned of literary products, an inspiring autobiography. But the book is not merely retrospective. It's also, implicitly, a prospective manifesto in the tradition of Martin Luther King's Letter from a Birmingham Jail. Zinn urges the moral necessity of wedding thought to action. Zinn movingly describes his early life, growing up poor in Brooklyn, working in a shipyard, which nurtured his indignation against those he refers to as the bullies of the world, those who used wealth or military might or social status to keep others down. In 1956, as a newly minted Ph.D., Zinn landed a job at Spelman, the Black Women's College in Atlanta, and he was galvanized by the civil rights movement. Zinn marched, helped integrate lunch counters, and served as a senior advisor to SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. For his activism, Zinn was fired by Spelman in 1963, even though he was a full professor with tenure. As Zinn tells us, he didn't fight the decision because by then he was aware there was a gap between law and justice. The second act of Zinn's academic life opened in Boston, where by the mid-60s he was a prominent figure in the fledgling anti-war movement. Though Zinn had flown as a bombardier in World War II, he came to view all wars as barbarous. Personal history repeated itself when Zinn's activism incurred the wrath of his boss, John Silber, the autocratic president of Boston University. The comic passages here where Zinn recounts Silber's nasty behavior suggest an ulterior motive behind this and most other autobiographies, that is, getting even. Zinn's autobiography dramatizes Milan Kundera's observation that the struggle of man against power is the struggle of memory against forgetting. Zinn joins that struggle here by reminding us that the civil rights movement was launched by countless small instances of individual courage, that those who opposed the war in Vietnam also acted with integrity. Remarkably, after all he's lived through, all the history he studied, Zinn remains an unrepentant utopian. He writes, "Human beings are not machines, and however powerful the pressure to conform, they sometimes are so moved by what they see as injustice that they dare to declare their independence. In that historical possibility lies hope." Zinn's critics are, of course, right. Nobody is more subversive to the status quo than a militant optimist.
Maureen Corrigan teaches English at Georgetown University. She reviewed Howard Zinn's autobiography, You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Bentham, Joyce Lieberman, and Dan Lachlan. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Fiction writer and Fresh Air commentator Dagoberto Gilb has told us about life in his working-class Chicano community in El Paso, Texas. His new novel, The Last Known Residence of Mickey Acuña, is based on Gilb's experiences when he lived at the Y. We'll talk with him about some of those adventures on the next Fresh Air.